Everybody listens, you know, with bated breath to what the Fed says it's going to do because it has this massive bazooka that can really alter the fate of where things go. But we got to remember, its set of tools is extremely crude. So if we're expecting them to engineer this just like butterfly soft landing of the economy with their very crude tools, we're kind of setting ourselves up for disappointment from the get-go.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Opto Sessions. I'm pleased to welcome Adam Taggart onto the show, founder and host of Thoughtful Money. How are you doing, Adam?
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
Where are you calling from today?
Today, let's see, if it's Tuesday, it's Florida. I'm West Palm Beach, Florida to moderate a debate for Zero Hedge, for those of your viewers that
are
familiar with the Zero Hedge website. I've been told that several million people are going to watch it, so I'm fast preparing for that today.
And that's later today or tomorrow?
That's later today, yep.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting day for it because we obviously had some interesting numbers come out today for CPI, et cetera. I thought we could start just by commenting on, so US markets obviously been hitting all-time highs recently. Until today, there's just been a relentless squeeze higher.
Yep.
It's from like early Feb. CPI has obviously dropped today. So this is Tuesday. This will be going out on Thursday. So a couple of days afterwards, obviously,
right.
The next
so
24
like
hours or day will be important
expecting
to see
somebody,
where market,
to,
the direction
know,
of the market.
Shoot the apple off of somebody's head with a bazooka.
Based on that,
yeah.
I just
it's
wanted to start
that,
by asking what your
tool.
Outlook is
yeah,
for the rest
like
of the year, possibly commenting
and,
on
maybe that apple
you know, the potential
be gone,
scenarios
but there'll be a
that
lot of collateral
might
destruction.
Involve.
Sure. It's not an organization that can finesse. I am not an economist or a market analyst by trade. I run a financial media program where I interview a lot of the top experts on money in the markets for my job. So if anything, I have sort of a consensus consolidation of the folks that I talk to. So I'll do my best to sort of let you know what I I've processed from all of those conversations that I've had. But your question was sort of about my expectation of where the market's headed for later this year. With the obvious disclaimer that really nobody knows, obviously.
Yes.
All we can do is take our best guesses. And the lens I look through, as I said, is sort of through the eyes of the many different experts I talk to who obviously have differences of opinion. But I like it when I hear similar conclusions from experts who get to those conclusions by different trajectories, right? Some of them still rely very heavily on macro data and fundamentals. Some are extremely technical oriented and they don't care about the fundamentals. They're just looking at market action and patterns. And I find when you have people from all these different disciplines, when they start singing from the same song sheet in certain parts of their projections, that's where I really pay attention. Because I'm like, if multiple people from multiple disciplines are coming to the same conclusion, that's probably giving me a higher probability that that conclusion is probably more likely to play out. So from the vast number of folks that I talked to, coming into 2023, everybody was rock solid sure that we were going to have a recession in early 2023, right? So everybody was super bearish. Of course, everybody pretty much got surprised by the market action that year. And end of the day, I think what really drove the markets in 2023 was liquidity, was rising net liquidity. There are a number of people who say, look, that's all that matters. Like you can almost forget everything else. And just if the tide is rising, it's going to bring financial asset prices up with it. And if it's sinking, it's going to bring them down. So maybe the short answer to my question is sort of wherever liquidity goes, you know, that's where the markets are going to go this year. But from the many folks I talk about, there's sort of this arc that's beginning to begin becoming clear to me as we entered 2024, and it's still playing out according to that script, which is that markets were going to really start having a great quarter in Q1. Everybody from the technology guys who just look a month or a couple months out, they were saying all our indicators are green. A lot of notable fundamentalists, Felix Zuloff is one who comes to mind. Said, look, he said, I think we're going to enter 2024 and the markets are going to do great and the economy is going to look stronger than folks had expected. And that's really what's playing out right now. You know, if you use the headline data as your guides, and of course the markets, you know, we'll see what happens from here, but up until pretty much today, you know, they've been pretty much in melt-up mode here in Q1.
Yeah.
And so the arc I've heard from folks is stocks are going to hit their zenith at the end of Q1. That like we're going to rise, you know, just full on party into the end of Q1. And then for whatever reason, just the markets have gotten too far ahead of themselves too fast, or real fundamental issues that have been kept at bay for much of the past year by the rising liquidity are really going to start making themselves felt. And we're going to start coming off that high, heading into the latter half of the first half of the year. So Q2 really. And then it gets interesting, because there are people who say, well, look, it's a, election year here in the States. They're never going to let the markets go down very much. But then others are saying, you know what? It may get away from all the central planners' ability to control things, especially if inflation, you know, starts resuming again, which was the data that we got today, which we can talk about in a minute. And so, going back to guys like Felix Zuloff, they think, okay, we're going to rise up to end of Q1. Then we're going to hit our peak. Things are going to start coming down, and that momentum is going to build. And while this wasn't a prediction on his end, you know, he says we could be down by like around 30% by the end of the year. And I had a similar conversation just a few days ago with Steen Jacobson from Saxo Bank, who he's not calling for that same 30% drop, but he's saying it's definitely within the realm of the possible. And you can make a case for it to fall even further. So I would say, I expect the markets to hit their peak in Q1, weaken. We'll see what's going to happen with the central planner intervention. They either will be late to the game, by which we have a pretty rocky end of the year and, you know, whatever implications that's going to have for the election.
Yeah.
But whether that happens then or whether it happens before, if the central bankers panic even more beforehand, that weakness is going to be met at some point by the central planners stepping in and saying, look, we're going to have to rescue the system again. And we're going to see probably a fairly subsizable stimulus program to try to staunch that bleeding, which is going to lead to yet another boost higher for asset prices, probably eventually some more inflation too. That boost in asset prices and that return of inflation, it's probably a 2025 phenomenon. So anyways, it probably beat the horse dead here, but spike in Q1, weakness, and then a little more uncertainty as to whether, you know, it gets met by the central response quick and early, or whether they're behind the game and we end up declining double digits into the end of the year.
Okay. So we're sort of saying if liquidity comes back in when things start to get bad later on, then potentially it will support things into the end of the year. But if they're late on that, we could have a pretty big drawdown.
Yeah.
But then a big drawdown might force them their hand, right, to pump in more liquidity.
Well, it definitely will. But, you know, if and when it does materialize, I think it definitely will. I think that is just the central planner playbook at this point in time. It is sadly the world that we live in now, which is the central planners just, they want it to be eternal summer for whatever reason, whether it's because they want the markets high and everybody to be happy, whether it's because they've got pressure from the administration, or whether it's, look, we have an economy that just can't function with the cost of capital that we have right now. And because it's so highly leveraged, and when weakness comes in, you have to meet it aggressively or else the whole thing just starts cascading downwards. But I think maybe the bigger question that I see, like that I ask a lot of the people that I interview, is right now we kind of have this narrative of, look, everything's great and we're going to have the soft to no landing. And in addition to that, if there is any weakness, because it's an election year, they're going to patch it up right away. And so that's the argument for like, hey, don't worry, just be along the market and it's going to be cared for. But then the other camp is like, look, you know, history, every time we've gone through a hiking and tightening cycle like we've been through, and we've just been through the most aggressive one in history in terms of the pace of it, there are lag effects. There are lag effects that materialize. And, you know, the whole reason why the Fed hiked was to bring down economic growth, to bring down inflation, and to cool off the jobs market. And, you know, if you look at the headline data right now, the economy is still going pretty strong. So they haven't really cooled it off that much. The headline jobs numbers, well, they look pretty great. They haven't really cooled the job market off that much. Now, inflation's come down. But you could argue that a lot of that is due from repairing the broken supply chains. So, you know, a lot of people, myself included, have scratched their head and said, hey, we're now a year and a half into this, you know, hiking and tightening cycle. Why haven't the lag effects arrived yet? This is why people were so confident in predicting a recession.
Yeah.
And I think that's where one, we put a gargantuan amount of stimulus into the system and more than most people could fathom. And it took a long time for that pig to get through the python. But secondly, there was that rising tide of liquidity that I talked about, net liquidity. But now that we're not pumping as much in as we did, those lag effects, you can make a pretty strong argument, will manifest themselves. Yes, they've been delayed, but they will arrive. But I think that's the big key question investors have to ask themselves right now, which is it different this time? And the lag effects are not going to materialize. And the markets are just going to keep coasting from here with all the support they've had and the quote unquote strong economic data we have, you know, or have we just pushed the lag effect into the future and we're now at the point in the future where those the can can't be kicked anymore and they really start expressing themselves at full strength. There's a lot of people that think that's going to happen too. And obviously the market has been betting in the former camp. And I think that could be the big surprise this year is if those lag effects really start winning out and Q2 feels sort of like a sensible enough time where they probably, if they're manifest, they will, you know, then maybe we are going to see more like a Zuloff type unwinding from hitting some high point of euphoria by the end of Q1. But then the lag effects really kick in. And remember, you know, when you step in with stimulus, yes, there are certain assets that respond really quickly to that respond to the news of that. But in theory, you know, stocks and everything should be driven by an increase in earnings from the stimulus. And it takes, there's a lag effect of stimulus. You pump it into the system. It takes a couple of quarters before you see that actually boost economic growth.
Do you think there's a possibility that because, you know, the central bank and the Treasury over the last 20 years, they've followed this sort of similar tactic of pumping in liquidity. Are the markets getting used to the fact of expecting it to come if there is a problem and they're, you know, therefore predicting it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and, you know, you could probably make the argument that, yeah, any concern the market has about weakness in the future, they've already priced in the central bank rescue. To it, yeah, but no, that is absolutely the playbook. Now, on the day that we're talking here, where inflation is coming in hotter than Wall Street expected, that is interesting. Like that is the fly in the ointment here for the market bulls, right? Where they had been praying, expecting, you know, the Fed to pivot pretty much ever since the Fed started the hiking campaign, right? And every time the Fed would come out and say, okay, we're not going to cut going forward. We're going to go higher for longer. And the market would say, I don't believe you. And we're going to price in all these rate cuts. And the market has actually had to, it's always had to be the market that's had to blink. Powell's actually been surprisingly consistent with his higher for longer campaign. But it didn't really matter. You know, stock prices kept going higher and higher. And again, I personally think that's the function of that rising net liquidity. But then Powell gave the markets what they wanted, right? He pivoted policy or guidance in December. You know, he went from beginning of December saying we're not even thinking about rate cuts to 2 weeks later saying, oh, yeah, we're totally talking about it. And we think we're going to do 2 and then 3 in 2024. You know, so now the markets, I think, pricing what? Like 6 rate cuts in? I think it was 7 at one point. I think it maybe come down a little bit. But all of that is predicated on the Fed actually getting inflation under control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Powell was saying, well, we need to start we need to start cutting it before we get to two because we have the downward momentum. And if we wait until we get to two to start cutting, inflation is going to go lower than we want. Which is funny because I doubt consumers really want to have I don't think they share that concern that he does. They would even lower inflation. But if inflation proves stickier than Powell thought, even just, you know, a week or two ago when he had his last press conference, he's going to have to go out and say, hey, you know, those three cuts I was promising you this year, we're having to dial that back, or we're going to push that further out down the timeline. And it's really hard for Wall Street to not have to, you know, be forced to write down some of its future projections in response to that. So, you know, if it turns out that this isn't a blip, like when the February CPI comes out, that's also a surprise to the upside, that could really start to trigger in more downside repricing for assets.
If the economy can't cope with the rates this high, mm-hmm. what happens? Like, they almost need to cut rates to, you know, so the economy can sort of like relax a bit and get going. But if they can't, then it could be, well, they'd have to have some sort of bad depression or something. I don't know how bad it could be on the back of this, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily use the word depression, but I mean, anything can happen. I would definitely say recession and not a light one. And, you know, all this gets back to, in my opinion, kind of the root cause of where we find ourselves right now, which is the Fed decided that it wanted to try to do away with the business cycle. Right? And, you know, businesses have a natural ebb and flow cycle, just like seasons do. And recessions are healthy, right? They clear out the malinvestment of the boom times, right? But we have adopted a policy in past couple decades where nobody wants the recession, right? And so you keep intervening to put it off, and that creates more malinvestment. It distorts true price discovery more and more each time you intervene. And it takes more intervention every time you intervene to get the same result. So what you end up doing is creating this very deformed system that, if left alone, dramatically wants to correct. It wants to clear out all the malinvestment, and it wants to get back to sustainable pricing. But nobody running the system wants that to happen, because they don't either want to take the losses on the investment side, or they don't want to take the political blowback if they're a politician, right? And of course, you can't keep the tide at bay forever. And what you do is, when the recession or correction finally arrives, it's much worse than it otherwise would have been, right? So I think that's sort of the box we're in. And now the Fed, especially since it joined forces with Congress when you had monetary and fiscal stimulus at gargantuan levels during the COVID crisis, it ended up letting the one genie out of the bottle that it has a hard time controlling, which is inflation, right? So the Fed has been challenged in the past, you know, couple years of, look, we have a lot of forces that want to bring this economy into recession, and the typical tools that we use to prevent that, we can't use, because they're going to make the inflation problem worse, right? So, you know, so that explains why they've been hiking and tightening. Now, there has still been an awful lot of liquidity going into the system, and as I mentioned, even last year, the net liquidity flows were positive, even though the Fed was tightening, right? And a lot of people scratch their head and say, well, hey, how can that happen? Well, there's been an unbelievable amount of fiscal spending that has still gone on. You know, the U.S. Deficit is at a level it's hardly ever been at in its history in terms of deficit as a percent of GDP. And we've only seen these levels when the country's been mobilized for war, like back in World War I and World War II and whatnot. But now that we're in a peacetime with a quote unquote strong, robust economy, we're deficit spending at these crazy, insane levels. There's also been things going on, you know, extraordinary support with the bank term funding program that was put out a year ago to support the banks during the banking crisis then. We've had like a lot of stealth liquidity programs that a lot of people aren't aware of, like the ERP, the Employee Retention Program, which was sort of a continuation of the PPP loans that were put out during COVID. So this has been a program that's been pumping billions every month into the economy, rewarding employers who didn't let go of their employees over the past years, right? And it really just turned into sort of a corporate subsidy program. That has just ended. The reverse repo program, it's a little bit hard for people to understand, but reverse repos actually drain money out of the system. But we are bringing down the amount of money that's been in the reverse repo program. And so when you're removing a negative, it's actually a positive on the system. But there aren't that many funds left to be drained. And when the reverse repo hits zero, which right now no one knows exactly when, if and when it's going to get to zero, but the current trajectory shows it getting there in March. That also is a removal of a tailwind to the economy. So you have all these things that, you know, if the Fed can't get back to easing anytime soon, you have a lot of the stuff that's been keeping the tide rising is beginning to get pulled away here. And if the Fed can't go back to easing quickly because inflation's sticky, then you actually can say, yeah, you know what, there's not a bad chance that we might see some rockiness later this year because the Fed's hands are somewhat tied and those lag effects are finally beginning to really be felt in earnest.
And I actually saw something interesting from Northman Trader about the employment figures that were really strong. It looks like the economy's very good, but it appears, though, they can be attributed largely to increased government hiring, not the private sector. And they're actually diverging away from each other, that, you know, there's an increase in government hiring every month, whereas there's been a decrease in the private sector. So the government hiring sort of masking this weakness in the private sector underneath it. Is that something you've seen as well?
No, that's absolutely true. And you know what? We're at the point, you know, there's a lot of government data that gets put out that people, you know, kind of argue about, like, you know, hey, how much can we really trust this data? I will say that jobs data is the data that is the least disputed in the sense that it's gotten to the point where pretty much almost nobody believes it. It doesn't map to what analysts are seeing who actually like study the employment landscape. And even the BLS, who puts together the payroll data. So that was the latest blowout report. I think it was something like 325,000 jobs were added. If you looked at the establishment survey, they have two main surveys by how they determine payroll. So 325,000, which was the big number that was touted. That's a survey that's done with a lot of kind of finger to the wind estimating. And there's what's called birth death model, which is it's really just their best guesstimate of kind of how many companies are being created and how many are going, you know, being shut down and what the jobs associated with each are. So there's a lot of big kind of assumptions that get baked into that. There's then the household survey, which is another survey they run, which is where they actually call households and they talk to real people and they say, hey, you know, what's your experience been with your job this month? And that showed a negative decline of jobs of, I want to say something like negative 35,000 or something like that. So even by the BLS's own two main surveys, one showed a blowout, several hundred thousand dollar increase in jobs. One showed actually a modest loss in jobs. But yeah, if you dig into the data, really the main hiring is being done by the government sector, right? So that's part of the deficit spending I was talking about. They're doing their best to keep getting out there, hiring people and spending. And if you look at over the past year, there have been pretty much on the net side, zero new full-time jobs created. All the job growth is coming from part-time jobs. Now we're seeing that, you know, there's an increase in people working multiple jobs. So when you look at a jobs market where all the job growth is in part-time jobs and it's basically people having to take on a second job, you know, that becomes a pretty good indicator that that's not a very good economy. Like these are people who are, to make ends meet, they're having to take on additional work. It's all part-time based. It doesn't come with benefits. It doesn't come with healthcare, right? It's a sign of a labor force beginning to sink beneath the surface of the water as opposed to, you know, being loud and proud and strong.
Yeah. And given all this, do you still think there is a possibility that we will hit this soft landing that basically have been priced into the market? Or is it starting to see, like, the indicators are starting to show there's some weakness there? I mean, people have been talking about market breadth as well being extremely weak.
Terrible.
Until recently where it improved, but today I think it's really hit things back again.
It's terrible. And just on the market breadth, I pulled these numbers. They're probably about a week old or so, yeah. Roughly in the same territory where over the past 12 months, the S&P was up about 20%, right? The Magnificent Seven, the seven stocks, were up like 70%. And so and they are basically responsible for pulling the S&P up to that 20% level. So if the S&P 500 is what's called a market cap weighted index, where the weight that each company gets in calculating the index is based on the size of that company. If you do what's called an equal weight index, where you give all the companies, all those 500 companies in the S&P equal weighting, that's only up by like 2.7%. over the past year. So yeah. Basically, the market cap S&P is 10x the equal weight S&P. And then if you look at the Russell 2000, right, which is small and medium sized companies, that's actually negative for the past year. So pretty much all of the growth in market value that we've seen over the past year has really come from just those seven stocks. It's a terrible breadth market.
And it's the first time this has ever happened as well, I think.
I know that it's the most concentrated it's been in 50 years. It very well could be that the concentration is in that few stocks right now. But I know, from a market concentration standpoint, it's the worst it's been in over 50 years. To your point about, what potential do I see for a soft landing? Look, like I said, nobody knows what's going to happen. Anything is possible. And I'll be the first one to say that I was one of those who was surprised that we didn't see a real manifestation of the lag effect in 2023. So could I be surprised again? Yeah, absolutely. And it's an election year. Like they'll be super desperate to do whatever they have to do to kind of keep things duct taped and bolted together, until we get through the election. But what I will say is, as an investor, if you are net long, right? You should just have at a minimum, a plan B for if you're counting on that soft landing. You should have some sort of trading strategy in your current portfolio that says, all right, look, if I'm wrong and we end up getting something harder than that, I've got my portfolio positioned well enough that I've got some protection to the downside. Yeah. And just as a reminder, like the institution that probably has the worst forecasting record in history is the Federal Reserve. Their forecasts are just terrible. They always miss them by a country mile. And we totally understandable. Everybody listens, with bated breath to what the Fed says it's going to do because it has this massive bazooka that can really alter the fate of where things go. But we got to remember its set of tools is extremely crude, right? And so it's like expecting somebody to shoot the apple off of somebody's head with a bazooka, right? It's not that precise of a tool. Yeah, they'll leave like a 20-foot crater, and yeah, maybe that apple will be gone, but there'll be a lot of collateral destruction around. It's not an organization that can finesse, right? So if we're expecting them to engineer this just like butterfly soft landing of the economy with their very crude tools, we're kind of setting ourselves up for disappointment from the get-go.
Yeah. Very interesting times. I also had a question about AI, and I don't know if you've heard about this theory that AI is going to help basically lead to a substantial increase in productivity in firms. But as a result of that, there will be a massive increase in GDP. And I don't know if you've heard about that theory, and I just wanted to, if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'll be honest and say I'm no AI expert, so take everything I'm about to say with that grain of salt. Sure, like yeah, I mean it, it's it, AI essentially is a productivity tool, right? And so it should boost productivity. That should boost profits and, you know, hopefully help companies be more efficient in selling and increase their revenues. And yeah, it should boost GDP. But will it be the ultimate game changer in the timeline that the market is pricing it in right now? I'm skeptical. I'm certainly skeptical that a company like NVIDIA is worth anywhere near what it's currently trading at in terms of like price to sales ratio. It's priced to whatever is better than a perfect fantasy. It's priced above that. But here's something that I don't hear talked enough about with AI is technology has always replaced human labor. Once we hit the industrial age, right? And it should, where it can do it more efficiently. But there's an issue you have to keep in mind, and this is something that The Economist goes back to his day and before, but he coined the term technological displacement. And he said technology should replace human labor when it can do a better job at it, but you have to manage the pace of the displacement. If you displace your labor faster than you can repurpose it to productive use, you end up creating a social problem whose cost mm-hmm. is oftentimes greater than the benefits you get from the introduction of the new technology.
And this could be one of the worst displacements because it's going to potentially happen so quickly.
It could happen super quickly. It seems to be able to go up and down the stack of talent, right? It's not just the entry-level worker. It goes up into the white-collar stack too.
Yeah.
And we tell ourselves, oh, it'll be great. Well, I'll have, you know, more time for leisure and whatnot. But it rarely ever works that way. And honestly, I don't want to get too far afield here, but when you have, I want to tie two other topics into this. One is immigration, where you have a bunch of people coming into your country that you have to figure out how do we put these people to productive use, right?
Yeah.
Right at the time where you have a technology that's trying to make you less dependent on humans. And then secondly, here in the States, we have it's something like 100 million U.S. adults age 18 plus who are considered as outside of the workforce. So when they calculate the unemployment rate, these people don't factor into that equation. They're just off on the side where the government has said, we've given up hope of these people ever getting a job, right? And some of them are too old to work, and some are in college, and some are, you know, domestic spouses, right, who are running families from home, right? But there's still tens of millions of working-aged, able-bodied people. And it's a growing cohort now in society where we have more and more people just kind of dropping out of working. They're just saying, hey, it sucks. Yeah. It's not working for me, right? Where we already have a labor utilization problem in this country. We have millions of people who could be working and should be working, but aren't. And so before we add on to those people with an influx of illegal immigrants that we don't know what we want to do with yet. And I'm not making a social call on this. I'm just making a pure economic one. And then you add to that new technologies, AI at the forefront of that wave that are, you know, fast enabling companies to employ less and less humans. That's a real dangerous cocktail for this technological displacement problem that Keynes warned about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really the government needs to help fix those problems. I don't know if it's something the private sector can do on their own.
I don't know, but I would just like to see, honestly, a public-private discussion around this. It's just saying, hey, what kind of strategy do we think makes sense, and do we want to put some guidelines and guardrails around this?
Yeah.
And that's putting aside the whole, like, will AI kill us all in the end anyways concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought now just to, like, a few questions before we wrap up, Adam. We just talk, obviously, you've interviewed lots of leading figures in finance mm-hmm. over the years. And I thought we could just glean from you if you've observed any common traits that among these experts that you sort of have put together.
Yeah, let's see here. I think I did my best of trying to boil their arc of where they think the market's headed, you know, over the next year at the beginning part of our conversation. So I won't beat that horse dead here. Let's see. I would say the vast majority, I oftentimes get sort of painted with a brush of being a bear, like, oh, you're just so bearish and you have all these people on your program that are bearish, right? And the honest answer is I don't filter for any sort of philosophy when I invite people on the program. It just so happens to be that the people I'm inviting on my program, my one criteria is that they have to be data driven. They have to have some sort of, you know, data framework to explain why they've come up with their outlook. And the reality is just most of the ones that I talk to are generally pessimistic about where things are headed right now. Like I said, you know, the contrary to that was some of the technical guys who said, hey, with my 1 to 2 month, you know, viewpoint, things look really good coming into 2024. But the people who have an outlook that extends beyond that, they are concerned of a lot of these issues that you and I have been talking about here. And I would say if I had to put them on team soft landing versus team lag effect, I would say the vast majority are on team lag effect, but not all. And one guy who sort of recently defected is Sven Henrik, Northman Trader, where he basically said, you know what? He's like, I'm actually like a reluctant bull now until proven otherwise, because he thinks the operating the operating manual now for the power structure is we have to manage the markets at all times. If we take our hands off, they start wanting to correct. So we're just going to have to just keep doing whatever we can to intervene and manipulate and support prices, because that's just where we are right now. And that's a tough opponent to go up against. And that is one thing I try to really warn bearish investors is, look, philosophically, I get where you are. You know, I'm kind of right there. But the market goes up way more often than it goes down in general, right? Just over history. I think it's like 85% of the time stocks go up. So to be a bear, you kind of have to be pretty good in your timing. And bull runs, or what do they say? You know, bull market, or the market takes an escalator up, but the elevator down. So corrections tend to be pretty contained time-wise. So you generally, to make money on the bear side, you've got to be pretty right in your timing, which is a hard thing to do. But also you have to realize, as a bear, you're going up against everybody, not just the bullish investors, but you're going up against every corporate CEO. You're going up against every politician. You're going up against every, you know, organization like the Fed, who wants the good times to keep on rolling, and they will change the rules of the game. So, you know, it's this interesting sort of like general concern about the, I would say almost all of them are concerned about the fundamentals, about where things are going. Not too many of them feel that the headline data that we're getting right now, 4+% GDP growth, disinflation that seems to want to continue down to 2%, today's data being a little bit of an exception to that, and strongly robust job market. A lot of them are saying, when I scratch this underneath the surface under every one of those, I don't have to scratch very much at all until I see a lot of things that concern me, right? But then a number of them were saying, but I don't know if I want to bet against that, because, you know, the whole power structure is trying to keep things supported. And again, it's an election year. So if they're going to be desperate, they're going to be desperate this year to keep things going. Yeah. Right? The other thing that they talk a lot about, or that I've been talking a lot about with them, is I think it's sort of a bigger picture thing. Yes, it's great if you can make some money this year and whatever the stock market does. But we are having a real bifurcation of society. And I think this is pretty true around the developed world, and not just in the US, where the spoils of the bounty are finding their way into fewer and fewer pockets going forward. And the wealth is really concentrating at an accelerating rate, where the middle class has just been, it's like an endangered species now. It's been getting increasingly squeezed. The younger generations, millennials, and certainly Gen Z, in a lot of ways are becoming so despondent about their future prospects that they're kind of giving up on the social contract. They're like, I just don't believe anymore what you're telling me. Go to college, you know, likely going in debt to go to college to get some corporate job somewhere. If I follow that, or I've been following that, that's not going to get me a house and a retirement, right?
Yeah.
And so I feel that there is this brewing social crisis that we're beginning to see some visible fault lines begin to emerge around, but it's still not really being talked openly about in the national dialogue. And I think that's the bigger issue here. Like, hey, who cares what the markets do, you know, in the long run, or, you know, over the next year or two or whatever. We care a lot more about just social cohesion in our society, continue to work. And ideally, at least in, you know, experienced developed countries, like we want people to believe in the fairness of the system so that they'll invest themselves in it. And
yeah,
that's what capitalism is. That's how you build prosperity, economic prosperity in a country. And if people start losing faith in that and opting out, you know, well, yeah, there goes your economic destiny.
You know, it's also meant to be over the next 15 years, I think the largest amount of wealth is going to be passed down. I can't remember the term they used for it. So I don't know if that will help with matters.
I'm a little skeptical about that. Now, yes, there's a tremendous amount of wealth that the boomers have right now, right? Yeah. To a certain extent, I think not as much wealth as expected is going to be passed down for two reasons. One, I think the boomers in general are... I think a good chunk of that, they all care about their children, but I think a good chunk of them are going to continue to fund their lifestyle right up until the end of their lives. Right. So yeah, they're not putting it all away. They're going to burn a part of it down. And then I personally think that we're going to have, I don't want to say necessarily market clearing events, though we may, but I think we're going to have some trends as the boomers really begin to age, where you're going to see these persistent multi-year, maybe multi-decade years of forced selling pressure in the assets that they own because they own so many of them, and those assets have to get liquidated. And a great example would be like housing. Mm. Right? Housing, super unaffordable right now, right? Boomers own the vast majority of the housing stock, and they want to sell their homes eventually to the millennial and younger populations who don't have the ability to buy them. And at some point, you know, the market's going to have to wake up and say, you know what? Yeah, the boomer's sitting here in a $3 million McMansion. There's no millennial that wants to buy that. And in fact, not only do they want to buy, they don't want to go into hock that much for that type of house. They don't even want to live in a big house anymore. Like, tastes are changing. And so, you know, a lot of boomers, a lot of that wealth, that 70 trillion wealth or whatever, like a good chunk of that's in the housing market. Well, that might take a 40% haircut, you know, over the next 20 years. Right. And it's crazy because you think about it, 10,000 baby boomers are hitting retirement age right now. Let's fast forward 15 years. It's going to be 10,000 baby boomers are dying or going into the nursing home, and their estates are going to have to be liquidated.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, I've not heard that before. So, yeah, that's really good. Thanks for that, Adam.
No worries. Demographics are fascinating. I've actually got an interview coming out on my channel the day after you and I are recording this, which may have been the day before this interview comes out, with a guy named Chris Hamilton, who has a great Twitter account called Economica, I think I pronounced it right, where he does a lot of great charts. I'm sure most of viewers have seen his charts, even if they don't recognize the name. But his big focus is demographics. And when you look at what's happening demographically, it's actually frightening. And I did not fully appreciate it until I recorded the interview with him. Like, for example, the U.S. is on track to become, if the status quo remains continues through 2035, in 2035, we will start having a negative population growth. Never had that before in our nation's history.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I heard on a slightly different note, the illegal immigration on a monthly basis is outpacing the births in the US at the moment. Something crazy like that, which is just...
It very well may be. And look, our immigration situation right now is just fully out of control, and certainly needs to be contained. And what is interesting, you know, I'm a big critic of how we're handling the border right now. And I think that we need to come up with a strategy and you know, figure out that strategy. And at the same time, figure out how we're going to also utilize our existing unemployed residents better too. And we take that whole thing into the equation. But having just looked at this, this demographic data, unless we can get the U.S. birth rate up dramatically in the next coming decades, which I think will be a pretty hard thing to achieve. Immigration is going to have to be a really big part of the solution, which I think just puts even more pressure on, well, let's get a good strategy in place, right? It's obviously just bringing in anybody willy-nilly, especially millions who don't necessarily have the skills or the education that we need. We're maybe just making the matter, you know, the issue worse for everybody, because you're going to have even more people drawing on the social programs that your elderly and others, you know, are counting on. It wouldn't surprise me that there's so many illegals coming in that they've passed our birth rate. But another reason why it doesn't surprise me is from those charts from that interview I did. The U.S. birth rate has dropped by 20% since, I want to say, like 2010-ish.
Yeah.
So I think over the past like 13, 14 years, the actual number of births in terms of millions of births per year has decreased 20. I mean, that's a huge drop in a very short period of time. And the trajectory is to continuing to go down. So like, I'm not shocked. Like sadly, pretty soon, it's not going to take that many illegal immigrants to surpass our birth rate, because our birth rate is slowing so quick.
Well, thanks, Adam. It's been great to catch up. That interview is on your YouTube channel, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah, so if people go to probably easiest thing to do is just go to my website, thoughtfulmoney.com.
Yeah.
And you'll see my latest links to the latest YouTube videos and the link to the YouTube channel there.
Yeah, they're great interviews. I highly recommend that.
Thank you
very much. Can you tell us a bit about Thoughtful Money before we wrap up?
Sure. So really quickly, Thoughtful Money is a financial media channel, mostly a YouTube channel, where I interview the top experts in money in the markets. I do like 4 interviews a week. We put out a fair amount of content. And the reason why I created the channel is because the education system here in the States, although I'm learning it's in a lot of other Western countries as well, really fails its students in terms of teaching financial literacy. It's so funny. You know, we go to school because we think it'll help us get ahead in life. And by getting ahead in life, most people think, well, it's going to help me make more money and be more financially prosperous. And yet we don't really teach finance. We don't even basics of personal finance. We don't teach classes on investing. We don't teach really practical things like how to take out a mortgage or handle, you know, credit card debt. We really kind of push people out into the world very unprepared. And it's amazing. They're not just rank and file employees. I mean, you get managers and executives out there. I mean, the top end professionals who might even manage a pretty big budget at work, but feel very underprepared to manage their own wealth and finances. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those people, what's so interesting to me right now in the media space is they've really gotten disappointed with traditional financial media because they feel like it's not giving them either the straight story. They feel like the information they're getting is biased and largely because of, you know, what the advertisers want to put out there that support mainstream channels. And it's just too superficial, right? They're just looking for sound bites. They're just producing more financial entertainment than they are producing, you know, practical information that I can use and apply to wealth building. So people are coming online to self-educate, and I created this channel to help provide that, what I like to call the financially nutritious content that people are looking for. And then just real quick, in addition to providing this content, a lot of people say, great, wow, you've got some great experts. I think they're smart. I really like what they're doing. I'd like to do something like those guys, but I just don't have the time, the expertise, or the bandwidth to do it. Can you help me? When we hear from those type of people, we connect them with financial advisors who take into account all the macro issues that we talk about on our channel. So that if somebody wants a financial quarterback to help them build and a plan and execute it for them, you know, it help them make those relationships too.
Amazing. Thanks, Adam. That's great. And I recommend everyone to check that out. There's some really good content on your site.
Well, thanks, Ed.
Thanks for this opportunity. Yeah.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Happy to do it anytime. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Adam.